Yeah, so this is work together with Yi-Chan So. He's a PSI student here. This is the master's program at Perimeter Institute, and of course with Giffrey. And yeah, so I'm going to be talking about how to apply matrix product states to a quantum field theory here in a certain sense, because obviously a conformal field theory is also a quantum field theory. Before I begin, though, I should point out that the x-axis will be abused throughout this talk. So every time you see a plot like this, the momentum, or the whatever the x-axis is, it's going to be the momentum or the conformal spin, is quantized. But to make the degeneracies that are present easier to see, we've abused it and spread out the points that should be at a single momentum slightly. Okay, just so that's clear. All right. Okay, so I'm going to start with a bit of background. So the background to this talk is the state operator correspondence in conformal field theory. This is quite a simple idea, really. So if you're not familiar with conformal field theory, just try to bear with me. So this is a Hamiltonian for a CFT. It's an integral over the energy density, which is the sum of the non-trivial, the non-zero components of the energy momentum tensor. So this is just an energy density. You put this Hamiltonian on a slice of a cylinder, and it turns out it has some interesting properties. So we've got the Hamiltonian, and we've got a momentum operator on this cylinder, which generates rotations around the circle. Now, under a conformal transformation, which is just a particular kind of coordinate transformation, we can take the cylinder to the 2D plane. And it turns out if you do that, this Hamiltonian, which is the generator of time translations, becomes the generator of dilations. And the momentum, the generator of rotations on the circle here, is still the generator of rotations on the plane. Why is that interesting? Well, so if we look at what we have in a conformal field theory, we have a bunch of fields or field operators which transform, you could say, covariantly under scaling transformations and rotations. So if you put a field operator at the origin of this dilation here, you see that under the dilation, this field operator phi at the origin picks up a factor, which we call the scaling dimension of this conformal field. And under rotations, it picks up a factor called the conformal spin. Okay, so from that we can infer, because the physics of a conformal field theory is invariant under a conformal transformation, that when we look at the spectrum of this Hamiltonian, we will also see these scaling dimensions up to some correction which has to do with the transformation. And the momentum, like the rotation over here, gives you a factor of the conformal spin. So what we have is a correspondence between fields or field operators in the CFT and eigenstates of this Hamiltonian. Okay. Are there any questions about that? Okay, so the setting we'll be working in is the setting of critical spin chains. So this is a spin chain. It's a bunch of particles, say atoms, at fixed positions on the circle in this case. So we'll be looking at these on the circle. There's a Hamiltonian, which defines interactions, usually between, say, nearest neighbors. And because we have a well-defined momentum or quasi-momentum, the states typically look like Fourier modes. So this is my attempt to draw a Fourier mode on the circle. Now, the main point of this talk will be that we have a method to identify the energy eigenstates on a spin chain with CFT operators in the CFT for a generic CFT. Now, let me explain a bit about this ansatz we have. So it's an ansatz we're calling a mode expansion of the Hamiltonian density. Now, it's motivated very clearly on the CFT side. What we're doing is proposing a lattice or spin chain analog of what would be an obvious thing to do on the CFT. So if you're familiar with CFT, you might think, oh yeah, that was obvious. If you're not, don't worry, just bear with me. So let's take the Hamiltonian again of the CFT. We might ask the question, okay, we might try to write the energy density T plus T bar in terms of some modes, some Hn, some Fourier transform of some objects Hn. And these Hn are simply the Hamiltonian with some position-dependent phase in front of the energy density. So if you work this out, you'll see that this is true. Now, we can do the same thing on the lattice. We take the spin chain Hamiltonian. We ask for some Hn, which are Fourier transforms of the local terms in the Hamiltonian, the Hj. And we get a very similar looking ansatz. So this is going to be the key object in this talk. We're going to talk about the matrix elements of these operators Hn. So it's just, again, the local Hamiltonian density on the lattice, but modulated by some position-dependent phase. And there's an overall scaling factor eta, which we'll set later on. So this is our proposal. We're going to use this to do what I said on the previous slide and get conformal data on the lattice. And by the way, I should note that H0 is, of course, just the lattice Hamiltonian with the additional scaling factor.
So there's some ambiguity in defining your Hjs, like you can define length things or sight things.
That's right. That's a good question. So that's a very good point. So I've glossed over that here. In fact, what we're going to do is apply a phase depending on where the operator is centered. So nearest neighbor will have a phase corresponding to the center of the nearest neighbor term, and on-site terms will have a phase corresponding to the site, and so on. So this is like interpreting these as, say, discretizations of derivatives and so on, right? Okay, so we're also going to look at how we can use matrix product states on the circle to do this. We want to use matrix product states for one. Well, we want to see if we can still do this using matrix product states or maybe tensor network states in general. And we want to be able to reach larger systems because there will be finite size corrections to the method we're proposing. Okay. And the matrix product state work is the stuff that's been done by Yijian. So he's been working hard on implementing all these numerical algorithms, and he's given us some excellent results. So the outline of the remainder of the talk is I'm going to talk about the emergence of 2D conformal symmetry, which is giving you a bit more background around this ansatz that I've just proposed, and I hope to make it clear to non-CFT people or people who don't know that much about CFT, including myself. I'd like to also explain how we extract the conformal data using these HN operators. And I'd like to show how we can reach large system sizes using matrix product states on the circle. And I'm going to talk a little bit about why you would generally be interested in using matrix product states on the circle to extract conformal data, even if you use different methods to this. OK, so first, conformal symmetry in 1 plus 1b. The setting, again, is critical many-body systems. So in a critical system, we say, for example, a chain of spins. We can look at correlation functions. So we can look at the correlation between this spin, and we can look at it as a function of distance. And what we find for a critical system is that these correlation functions have a power law decay, and the power law exponent is universal. What that means is that for a whole bunch of microscopic Hamiltonians, we get the same universal exponent here. So systems fall into universality classes, where all the systems within a class share the same exponents. Now, we're also familiar with the idea of emergent symmetries in these many-body systems. So for example, if we have a system which has emergent Lorentz invariants, let's say it's a 1D system, we expect the dispersion relation to look linear for small momenta. In other words, at large scales, the system looks Lorentz invariant, even though at small scales, it's not. Now, if we add to that scale invariance, then we get 1 plus 1D conformal symmetry. And we also see that this emerges in critical spin chains. So if we look at a spin chain on the circle in this case, and we look at the spectrum of excitations, so excitation energies, this is just the energy gap from the ground state, and the momentum on the x-axis, we see a very interesting pattern. So we see the Lorentz invariant line here. This is an indication that we have emergent Lorentz invariants. But we also see these rather suggestive gaps between the levels here. Now, these gaps are well understood these days, thanks to people like John Cardi. He's one of the people who have investigated how these gaps, these energy levels, and these momenta are related to the conformal to the scaling dimensions and the conformal spins of the operators in the CFT. Okay, so that's very interesting. So we can see, I forgot to mention, of course, this is up to some finite size effects. So this is the key part here. We don't see just the scaling dimensions, we have some finite size effects which are not universal and which shift the levels. Now, we could try to get information about the CFT from this emergent conformal symmetry signature that we see on the lattice. Now, what data can we hope to obtain? Well, it turns out that you can describe a conformal field theory in 1 plus 1b using a very few pieces of so-called conformal data, including the central charge, C, a list of so-called primary fields, and I'll be clear about what they are later on, including their scaling dimensions and their conformal spins, and a list of operator product expansion coefficients. And don't worry about what those are. I won't really talk about these very much or at all, but they determine three-point correlators and higher order correlators, endpoint functions. So we could extract some of this from the finite size spectrum based on what we just saw, based on Cardi's work, for example. We could do finite size scaling, and we could try to determine some scaling dimensions and some conformal spins. But the question is, can we get more than we can just from looking at the spectrum? Can we get more from this finite size data? And the key thing is, we don't only have a spectrum, we also have access to the eigenstates. So to show what more we could hope to get, let's look at the structure that is present in the CFT. So this is now not a lattice system. This is an example of the Ising CFT, which emerges in the spin chain Ising model. You can see that I've colored in the spectrum, and it looks very similar to the finite size spectrum you saw on the previous slide, but we've identified these states. So there are, as I promised, some so-called primary fields which have corresponding primary states. These have scaling dimensions specific to the model. There's a central charge equal to 1/2. And the rest of the states I've colored according to the primaries. Now, this is because the spectrum consists of towers of states, one tower per primary field or primary state. And the towers can be built up from the primary using ladder operators, which are elements of the Virasoro algebra representation on the CFT. For those who know what that means, otherwise just think of them as ladder operators. So what do these ladder operators do? Let's take a state represented by this blob. So the ladder operator L minus 1, it could be L minus n, and in general L minus n just goes further in this direction, takes us one spin higher and one scaling dimension higher, or one energy higher, if you like. L plus 1 is the conjugate operation, and it goes in the other direction. And there are also ladder operators denoted L bar, which take you in the orthogonal direction. So importantly, the minus operators always go up in the scaling dimension, and the plus always go down. So let's take an example. In the Ising model, we have a primary field called the identity, which is, by the way, present in any CFT. And it turns out that the first state we can build by acting on the identity with ladder operators is, well, there are two. They are the stress energy tensor states, T and T bar, corresponding to the stress energy tensor operators in the CFT. So you get them just by applying these ladder operators to the identity state. And interestingly, they come with a factor root C over 2. Remember that for later. And we can continue. We can continue from here. We can apply more ladder operators and build up the entire tower of states for the identity. And we can do the same for the other primary states in the CFT. So just a reminder then, primary states being the bases of these conformal towers cannot be lowered by a lowering operator. They are annihilated, in fact, by the lowering operators. So they're special in that way. So it actually turns out it's enough for them not to be lowered by L1 and L2, or L1 bar and L2 bar. If you look at the Virasoro algebra, you realize that that's sufficient for them not to be lowered by any of the L plus N operators. So the question we're asking is, are there equivalent ladder operators or approximate ladder operators on the spin chain? Can we do the same thing? Can we start with the primary states on the chain, on the spin chain, and build up their conformal towers? Can we use them to identify the energy eigenstates, all of these guys here, with CFT operators at finite size? So, lattice ladder operators, that's what we want. So I showed you the ansatz already. What we did was we derived this, these Hamiltonian modes by asking what the analogous operator to these Hamiltonian modes on the CFT would be if we were to construct it on the lattice. And we came up with this HN operator. So what does this do? What do we expect it to do? Well, it's an ansatz for just a linear combination of these ladder operators. So in the CFT, this HN that I showed you on the previous slide is just LN plus L minus N bar. What does it do? If you apply it to some state, some blue blob state, with plus one, it takes you to the left. It takes you up to the left and down to the left. Minus one would take you up to the right and down to the right. And increasing the integer would take you further in either direction. So can we use this linear combination of ladder operators on the lattice? Can we use this lattice proposal for that operator to identify the states of the CFT without opening the big yellow book, which we would otherwise use to identify the CFT? So example, simplest example, the transverse field Ising model. We use exact diagonalization to demonstrate the principle here, but this method, as you may have noticed, is applicable using any diagonalization technique. So here's the spectrum. This is the low energy spectrum of the Ising model at n equals 14 spins, very small system, very easy to compute. We want to identify first the primary states, the basis of the conformal towers. So if this HN operator on the lattice is doing what it wants, then we can use it to try to detect which of the states cannot be lowered in energy up to finite size corrections. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the eigenstates alpha and their matrix elements with the other eigenstates under this combination of H1, H-2, H2, H-2, which if you think about it, contains all the lowering operators with 1 and 2 in them. So
you get some eigenstates with standard matrix product methods.
Yeah.
And then that's an identification. You're not trying to use those operators to create them in the first place.
No, so it's important that we're not, for example, diagonalizing the HN. We're diagonalizing the usual Hamiltonian, and then we're looking at the matrix elements of these HN in this eigenbasis.
Mm-hmm.
Right? However you get those states. Okay, so let's take an example. This is not a primary. So I have hit, so alpha is this circled state in the middle, and the beta, well, I've looked at the overlap, the matrix elements of this operator with all the other states in the spectrum, and the red blobs are showing you where the non-trivial, the non-zero overlaps are. So you can see that this operator is raising this state up here, and lowering it down here. It's lowering it with a significant contribution, so we don't think this is a primary. But this is a Yeser primary. So as you can see, when we apply the operator to this state, we are only raising. Now, you may say, OK, but there were no states down here that I could have lowered it to. So this was a pretty easy example. We're going to see a harder example later. And it's if I proceed to the next slide, you'll see that the only primaries we identify are indeed the correct primaries right at the bottom here. We don't get any erroneous identification of primaries up here, which is still something non-trivial. Yes?
Do you get exactly the eigenstates when you apply these H's on the ground? Or you get some kind of lots of other ground?
Yeah, so it turns out in the Ising model, we get pretty much complete, it's completely unambiguous. So these operators, how should I put this? Yeah. So if
the
I play,
it's really zero with all the other ones.
It's really zero. In this case, the red blobs are really zero size on the other states. Yeah, indeed. In this particular case, so we see very minor finite size corrections. In fact, the only finite size corrections we see for the Ising model are just the size of the non-zero blobs. They change slightly depending on the size. But all the zero blobs are always in the right places. See what I mean?
Right. So do you have, it'd be useful, you know, it'd be nice if this worked on relatively small systems.
Yes.
And so is there an issue do too small a system and it starts blurring out, or what's the...
Well, so in general, yes. But in the Ising model, this is still all for n equals 14, and we're seeing very clear identification. So this is just a fixed system size. We haven't done any finite size analysis yet, but we'll be looking at that for a more challenging model in a second. So we've identified... Any other questions at this point? No. We've identified the primary states now, or we think we have. Well, we know we have in this case. Now we want to get the towers. So to get the towers, we're just going to look at some finite transformation composed of powers and products of powers of H1, H-1, H2, H-2. And we're going to take the overlaps with the primary states. So we're going to look at each of the remaining eigenstates and see where there's a non-trivial overlap with this operator for some primary. And if we do that, for example, we look at the matrix elements with this primary of this operator, we find indeed there is a very nice sorting of the remaining states into ones with red blobs and ones without. And again, there is no ambiguity in this particular case of the Ising model. So that's very nice. This means we can get exactly a precisely unambiguous identification of each of the states in the spectrum with a particular conformal tower. And indeed, you know, it's not necessarily what you would expect if you... So I'll compare it to the exact spectrum in just a moment. I'll do that in just a moment. But before I do that, we haven't yet normalized the spectrum. So we still have energies here. So what I would like to do now is normalize these operators and set the eta scaling factor. So to do that, I'm going to require that the gap... I changed this slide quite recently. Okay. What I want is for the scaling dimensions to come out of this. I want them to be the gaps according to H0, which is just the system Hamiltonian rescaled, right? So this is just a rescaling of the Hamiltonian, and I want the rescaling to give me estimates for the scaling dimensions of these operators, right? So in order to scale and set this eta factor, I'm just going to set the scaling dimension of a particular state to a known value. So I'm going to choose the stress tensor state, or the energy momentum tensor state, because that's always present in a CFT, and we know that it has scaling dimension 2. So that's going to determine my eta. And with that, I get the final result for the spectrum. So on top, we have the CFT result I showed you earlier, and now we have the correctly scaled finite size result at n equals 14. You can see I've used 2 here for the scale of the stress tensor state, so that's exact, but the rest of the scaling dimensions are slightly corrected by these finite size effects. But nevertheless, we have been able to identify each of these states with the correct conformal tower. And if you compare this top left corner, you see that you might not have guessed, in fact, you wouldn't be able to guess by just looking at the spectrum at one finite size, that this one is the blue one and this one is the orange one and so on. So this is non-trivial information. Yeah.
So the reason you fix that eta is just so that you can plot it with the conformal
with the correct scaling dimensions
instead of energies.
That's a reason. So one reason to fix eta is to do that, so we can get estimates for the scaling dimensions of each of these states. So the other reason is so that we have a comparison across system sizes. So we'd like to be able to compare the overlaps that we were looking at before across system sizes to see how those scale, for example. So this eta scales all the HN and not just H0, right? Okay. Now, we can also estimate the central charge, which is another reason why we need the scaling to be correct, because it's going to be a matrix element of one of these HN. So if you recall from before, if I apply in the CFT L minus 2 to the identity, I get the stress tensor state with a factor root C over 2. Okay. Now, the H minus 2 on the spin chain, we expect to tend towards L minus 2 plus L plus 2 bar. And L plus 2 annihilates this primary, so we only get the L minus 2 contribution. So we expect, as we take the system size to infinity, to get just this T state with the correct scaling factor. So this means at any finite size n, we can get an estimate for the central charge by looking at the expectation value on the ground state, on the identity state, of this operator here, h minus 2 squared, essentially, times 2. And indeed, if we look at this now, we're going to look at a few different system sizes to see how this estimate scales. We find that this expectation value estimate for the central charge gives us an extremely accurate extrapolation when we go to the continuum. And this is for system sizes still using exact diagonalization up to 18. But we'd like, oh, yeah.
So I'm still confused about the question of Steve. So these HNs are not kind of unique. So by, because the Hamiltonian can always kind of add a term on one side. And
this is true, yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So how does it? So.
Yeah, so we haven't specified a unique formula in this. I haven't done that yet. But so there's some freedom, there's an overall phase freedom, for example, and there's a freedom to exactly how you choose to put the phase on each of the terms in the Hamiltonian. And what we found is that you get correct-looking results if you treat the terms as if they were discretizations of field objects, so say derivatives. So a derivative would become a nearest neighbor term, but the center, you know, the point where it acts should be between the two sites, for example. And the on-site terms should be local terms acting at the sites. But I can explain that again. Again later, but that seems to be very important. Otherwise, you get additional finite size corrections from making a mistake. Are there any other questions at this point? Yes?
I mean, I would have maybe thought that since you're looking only at very low momentum modes, that it doesn't matter too much where you place these operators, but is that maybe not right?
Well, it doesn't matter too much. So you still see, if you make this mistake and you just take all the local terms, say the on-site term and the nearest neighbor term in the Hamiltonian, give it the same phase, the same local phase, you'll see the same behavior, but there will be errors. So you won't have this nice behavior where you get completely unambiguous determination of the towers, you'll get some errors, and you'll see that they scale away as you increase the system size. That's probably just because the oscillation that you're applying to the Hamiltonian term becomes broader and broader as you increase the system size for a particular HN. Right? Okay, so. But we'd like a bit more of a challenge. So it seemed like the Ising model was too easy, really. So what we're going to do, so the Ising model is also, of course, a free theory. We can solve it exactly. We really know everything about it. So let's take a non-free theory. Let's take the three-state Potts spin chain. And this is its finite size spectrum. So it's a bit of a mess compared to the Ising model, right? There are lots of states. And it turns out the Potts CFT also contains a lot of primary states, far more than in the Ising model. And some of them are way up in the spectrum here, or we expect them to be. So it's a lot more difficult, potentially, than the Ising model. But it turns out we can do a pretty good job still. So this is the CFT prediction for the spectrum of the Potts model. You can see the primary fields, the primary states, are the diamonds. I've labeled some of them, but I haven't labeled them all because there's no need for this talk. And the conformal towers are color-coded as before. You can see there's a primary state way up here at level 6. So this is a much harder task than it was for the Ising model. But we can still, even at a finite system size of n equals 14, correctly identify all of the primary states. And we get a good identification of the conformal towers. But it turns out it was a bit harder than the Ising model. If you look and compare the circled blobs on the left and right, you'll see there's a cyan blob on the left side where there isn't in the right side, for example. So it seems like we're descending this primary state down to here. So you might ask, well, why did we call this a primary state then? I mean, it seems like it's being lowered. Why did we call it a primary state? Well, we did that because we did a finite size analysis. And if you look at these errors, the size of the matrix elements which lower these primary candidate states and how they scale as you increase the system size, you find that these errors convincingly go to zero. So we've only gone up to n equals 14 here, But it looks like the trend is towards these lines going closer to the expected zero. For comparison, here is an operator we do not consider to be a candidate for a primary, and it clearly goes up here and nowhere near zero. So we're pretty convinced. So these are, in fact, the only operators in the only primary candidate states in the POT CFT that have significant errors. The rest do not, but these two do. And that's actually consistent with the known finite size corrections in the POTS model, but I won't go into that just now. So that's nice. It looks like the finite size corrections, even though this was a harder model, we found finite size effects, but these finite size effects really are finite size effects. They seem to go away. And even for relatively small system sizes, we can make a good prediction for the POTS model still.
Ash?
Yes?
Why did you choose that specific power for the dependence of the system size?
Good question. Why did I choose 4/5 for this power? Well, you know, one approach would be to find out when this looks linear. But actually, this is the leading finite size correction in the POTS model. This is
you know that from the finite size analysis of the CFT
side. Yes. This is so. If you look, well, yeah, indeed. So you can analyze what allowed corrections there are for the lattice model, and this is consistent with the leading order correction in the POTS model.
Is it related to the central charge?
It's related to the scaling dimension of the X primary. So it turns out the lattice model is perturbed by the X primary. Okay. Any other questions here? Good. So the central charge, as for the Ising model, also comes out nicely again. The correct result is 0.8. And for this finite size extrapolation, we get 0.798. Yeah.
You say that this last, can you go one second?
Yeah, of course.
You say that here that 4/5 has to do with the fact that the X operator is like,
I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah, a perturbation of your CFT.
Yeah.
So in saying you could try to get like a better lattice Hamiltonian.
Oh, that's a good point.
Closer to this, like it's a better lattice version of the CFT.
Yeah, so if you know the finite size effects present, you could attempt to compensate for them. That's possible in principle.
You could like use Mera or MPS to like get rid of some irrelevant terms in your Hamiltonian.
Oh yeah, that's another thing you could do. Yeah, indeed. So you could use a partially renormalized Hamiltonian to do this whole approach. Yeah. But what I think is more interesting is that you could actually use these finite size effects to determine which operators perturb the lattice Hamiltonian. But I won't say any more about that right now. Okay, so this is the checkpoint. You've reached it. Congratulations. So we've seen this Hamiltonian density mode expansion does indeed act like a conformal generator would up to finite size corrections on finite spin chains. We've seen that we can use it to identify the energy eigenstates on the finite system with conformal fields. And we haven't made any assumptions at all about the underlying CFT. We've just looked at the expectation values, the matrix elements of these operators. And we've seen we can estimate the ground state from just the central charge from just a ground state expectation value for each system size. And we get a nice extrapolation from that. And the method that we've used to identify states, this HN, is completely independent of whatever technique you use to diagonalize the Hamiltonian. So on that note, I'm going to talk now about using matrix product states on the circle to go to larger systems.
I have a question. Maybe I'm jumping ahead, but
sure.
Can you construct a particular combination that tries to start from one of the principal states to go to a particular guy on the tower and use that as sort of an onslaught?
You mean, so instead of a combination that does this and this, just have one that goes one way, for example? Yeah, so there is a natural approach to getting a lattice ansatz for just Ln. It involves having a lattice momentum density, which you can derive from the Hamiltonian. But we have found that there are additional finite size effects coming from doing this. So actually, it becomes slightly harder to use these on the lattice, at least using this approach to identify states. But yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah. And there may be other approaches to getting a better Ln.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So matrix product states on the circle. So matrix product states on the circle has a long history. You know, it's as old as DMRG. Algorithms for finding ground states have been developed over the years with tricks for getting more efficient results, or results more efficiently, rather. And algorithms for finding excited states have also been developed. And the cost of these algorithms in the size of the bond dimension is higher than it would be for open boundary condition MPS, or usual open system, open boundary condition DMRG. So we have a scaling of chi to the 5, where chi is the bond dimension to find the ground state. By the way, this is for critical systems. I know there are improvements to this for gap systems, but for a critical system, you really have to live with this chi to the 5 scaling, and chi to the 6 to find excited states. So you might ask, why would we do this? Well, so there are many ways of extracting conformal data from matrix product state techniques. You could use finite matrix product states or open system, open boundary condition DMRG together with usual finite size scaling techniques to extrapolate central charges from the spectral data that we saw before at the beginning of this talk, to extrapolate central charges, scaling dimensions, and so on. You can also use infinite MPS together with a technique which has been called finite entanglement scaling, where you take an infinite system and instead of changing the size of the system, you change the bond dimension of the MPS and see how quantities scale in that. And there's been some progress in extracting conformal data from these techniques as well, including scaling dimensions. One thing about these techniques for extracting scaling dimensions, however, is that you do need a lattice ansatz for the field operator. You need to know what the field operator looks like on the lattice in order to extract a scaling dimension, because you're extracting it in the end from correlators of these operators. On the circle, we've seen that you can get scaling dimensions without that information. The time costs, however, is much cheaper. We get bond dimension to the power of 3 scaling for these algorithms. So it's an interesting question to ask, which is better? There may be a trade-off here, right? So let's look at a result for, this is an MPS finite size spectrum from the Ising model on the circle. I think it's for 256 sites, n equals 256. So we can go to much bigger systems here. What I haven't said so far, if you're not familiar with doing numerical diagonalization, the exact diagonalization task technique we were using previously, it obviously scales exponentially in the system size. So we can only go to maybe 40 sites before we've maxed out the biggest supercomputers we have on the planet. With MPS, it's very easy to go to, say, hundreds of sites, thousands of sites, as Steve has already been discussing. So this is a finite size spectrum for the Ising model. And we can again use this known relation between the energy levels and the scaling dimensions to extract conformal data. So what do we get? Let's try doing this. So this is again work by Ijan. He's been busy finding MPS ground states and excitations, and he's extrapolated scaling dimensions here for 2 of the primary states. So for the spin primary in the Ising model and for the energy density primary. Now the correct results are 0.125 for the scaling dimension of the spin and 1 for the scaling dimension of the energy density. And I've just zoomed in these numbers down here. You can see that we get a very nice result up to 5 significant figures down here.
Which of the methods was used?
I should point out, this is not yet using the HN operators we've talked about. This is simply taking the energy levels. In general, you need to identify the states with an operator. If you already know that a state is the spin operator, then you can look at how its energy level with the correct scaling changes as you increase the system size.
But just to get the state to start with, you listed a variety of approaches.
Oh, yeah. So this is with matrix product states on the circle with a particular ground state solver, which I'll discuss in just a moment. So this is MPS with periodic boundary conditions. So this is an example of using finite size scaling with on the circle, using MPS to reach large system sizes. So that works very nicely. So let's compare this with what you can get from, say, infinite matrix product states. So there was a paper by Stojevic et al., including Frank, and they used some very cunning techniques to extract scaling dimensions from infinite MPS. They used bond dimensions going up to about 64, and they got some nice values for these same scaling dimensions. Now, we use bond dimensions up to about 36 and system sizes up to 256 to calculate these estimates. And you can see there is kind of a trade-off here. So although the cost of this algorithm that we're using on the circle is scaling order chi to the 6 and its most expensive part, we can get a nice estimate for these scaling dimensions for a much smaller bond dimension than we apparently could from the infinite MPS data. Okay. But you know, the key point of this talk, these HN operators that I was talking about in the first half, we can also use these to extract conformal data using from the MPS data. So whereas with ED we had a system size of n equals 14 and we had an exponentially scaling cost of the computation, we now have a cost that scales linearly in n, chi to the 6, maximum cost, and we can get a very nice result at large system sizes. So you can see the finite size corrections present in the ED calculation are much less severe in the MPS computation. And we have still managed to identify all the states correctly. So it seems like the MPS has not destroyed this HN ansatz that we were proposing previously. You might have thought that maybe something about making a finite bond dimension, a finite entanglement approximation could mess this up. But no, it seems we still are able to identify all these states correctly. Now, one other interesting point about this is that the ansatz we're using for excitations is what we're calling a single sum ansatz. This means what we're doing is we're taking the state, which is translation invariant, and is parameterized by these A tensors, and we're just perturbing it locally and translating this perturbation with some momentum, P. Right? Now, generically, you might expect that you would need different kinds of excitations to capture everything in the system. So you might expect scattering states, for example, where you have separated particles with different momenta. But actually, we've seen just now in the previous slide that we can capture all of the excitations we're interested in the CFT using this single sum ansatz. So this is now a comparison between the exact CFT prediction and the MPS result. We can see there's nothing missing, and we've correctly identified all the states. So this is telling us something about the nature of these CFT excitations, that they are indeed have this one particle or single sum form. And actually, that's consistent with what we know about the continuum. But I won't go into the details about that right now.
Have you tried to use the form of the operators to try to, there's one matrix that's different that you're.
Yes.
Can you guess, estimate what B is from?
Right, right. So you might, this is a very good question. So we have considered this. We haven't tried it out yet. So you might try to start from the ground state, right? And then since we think these HN operators are acting as ladders, we take the ground state. We could use a ladder operator to get an estimate for the excited state, right? And then we could use that as a starting point for our variational optimization. So yeah, this is a nice idea which we'd like to try out. We've thought about it, but we haven't tried it yet.
You can only do that within one conformal target, right?
So assuming these HN are working correctly, of course, you need to start from the correct primary, right? So you might need a few excited states in order to get everything. But it's already pretty good to get the primary descendant, the stress tensor state or the energy momentum tensor state, because that allows you to scale everything. It allows you to get this central charge estimate already.
This other kind of excited states, all the primaries are also of this form with this beast, so you cannot apply another kind of prime. Because then you would have two beast.
So you might think that you would need two Bs, right? If you started from here and you go up here, but it turns out that the excitations appear to have this single B form, even if you take a descendant of a different primary. But yeah, if you wanted to initialize the variational ansatz in this way, you'd probably have to, I mean, I guess you'd have to make some additional assumptions about how these Bs, these two Bs that you would have interact with each other, right? So you'd have to assume you can just combine them, I guess, into a single B. But that's a possible.
It works clearly for the identity tower and for the rest.
Okay, so I wanted to say a little bit about the algorithm we're using to get ground states on the circle. What we're using is inspired by some recent research in getting ground states in matrix product states in various settings. We're using a local gradient descent method. So actually, Martin Ganal is going to tell us about using this method or similar method to get ground states for continuous matrix product states later. So this is partly inspired by his work. So the setting we have is a translation invariant matrix product state on the circle. You know, it looks like this, where we have this matrix product of A's and the trace taking us around the circle. There's a gauge freedom, which means we can insert identities between each of these tensors in order to transform A's. We can do this in a way that breaks the translation invariance if we want to. Why would we want to do that? Well, because we want to work in the so-called center gauge or an analog of the center gauge for MPS on the circle. And indeed, this has been effectively done in previous algorithms for finding ground states of MPS on the circle. But we want to work in the center gauge where we have a center matrix AC, and we have left canonical form AL, right canonical form AR. And to complete the circle, we have some AC complement, which is just whatever it needs to be. So this is for the MPS experts in here. If you don't know what that means, don't worry about that. What we do is we take the derivative with respect to the tensor on a single site. So the local derivatives. This is what it looks like. We just, since it's linear in these parameters, we just erase this tensor. We have to reorthogonalize the basis for the state by multiplying it by some object called N inverse. And N is, and that defines our gradient. So we go from the derivatives to the gradient by multiplying by this thing. Don't worry too much about what this thing is. It's just it's just the inner product of the Hilbert space induced on this space of parameters. But it's the main point is that this is the gradient, right? This is the gradient with respect to these parameters that were here. So we take this gradient, we add a little bit of it to this original AC, which parameterized that site previously, and we get some AC prime. And we find this factor alpha by doing a line search. So this is a form of gradient descent. We try to find the minimum in the energy along this search direction. And this gives us a new AL prime, AR prime, AC bar prime, and so on. We update the global state from this local change. So it's in a way, it's DMRG-like. We're just not finding the ground state locally. We're just doing gradient descent locally.
So actually, how do you extract this AL prime from just the AC prime?
Yeah, so we're doing that by just taking the C inverse, if you like, from the previous state and multiplying it on to the AC, the new AC. So it's an approximation, but it appears to work well enough. I say C because I know what Utah means by that, but yeah.
But then they're not exactly. These are not exactly in
the last form. Sorry. Wait a second. I have to get back to you on that one. I'll talk to Ijan about what he's been doing as well, because he's the guy who's been developing this algorithm, programming it, and he knows exactly what's going on. Right? Okay. The point is, we can use this to minimize the energy very efficiently. So this is an example. What's the system size? I think it's N equals 128, 128 sites at a bond dimension of chi equals 18. This is from, I think this is from the initial state was taken from a smaller system size. Is that right? Yeah. So we have a reasonable energy already, but as we apply the algorithm and do these local gradient descent steps, we see a very rapid convergence towards what we'll take as the minimum energy for that particular bond dimension, right? And then we can use that as an initial state, expand the bond dimension, and do this again. Anyway, the point is we can do this. The cost, as is known from previous attempts to get ground states on the circle, is order chi 5 times n. And that's worked very nicely for us. OK, unless there are any questions about that MPS part, I'll move to the conclusion. So we have seen, again, that this Hamiltonian density mode expansion does act as a conformal generator, a ladder operator, or a combination of ladder operators on finite spin chains. We have used it to identify energy eigenstates with conformal fields or field operators without making any further assumptions about the underlying CFT. So we think this is applicable not just to minimal models, but also to other models, not just even C equals 1 models, but perhaps higher conformal, higher central charge models. But you know, this is we need to test that, obviously. So we can estimate the central charge again. So we have what, as far as we know, is a new method of identifying the central charge from a ground state expectation value. The method is independent of the diagonalization technique, but MPS on the circle do appear to be a very nice choice for doing this. Okay. So with that, I'll thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Ash. Any questions?
Okay.
Could you apply this warp to PEPs on the Taurus?
Say that one more time.
Could you apply this warp to PEPs on the Taurus?
PEPs on the Taurus. So we're relying on having this this operator state correspondence. So that means we need a situation which is analogous to radial quantization for 2D CFT. So I don't think the torus is suitable for that. But you could do it on the sphere. But there are, you know, there are issues discretizing the sphere. But you know, in principle, you could do it on the sphere. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Maybe related to that, I guess. Maybe that's even what you meant, but doing some tests on the torus, you often don't get the original Hamiltonian. You can expect objects like boundary Hamiltonians or entanglement Hamiltonians, which are in one-dimensional systems living on a circle, but which are given to you in the form of an MPO. Something related to the Pepsitons.
Yeah.
Have you already thought about how you would do it in that case?
So we have thought a bit about it. So one could attempt, for example, to variationally obtain a local Hamiltonian from this MPO. Right? You could take a basis of local operators and sum it up and then try to optimize that based on your MPO. That's one thing we've thought about. I did also have some other ideas about how you might do this. Maybe there's a way of doing the same thing by doing a bulk modulation of the Hamiltonian, but I really have no idea. If anyone's interested in talking about that and knows more about it than I do, then that would be great. Glenn. Yeah.
Is there any hope of getting OPU coefficients from something like this?
Yes, is the short answer. This is helpful because we can identify each state with its CFT operator. If we can do that, we can construct a cost function for finding a lattice version of the. So, basically, let me step back a little bit. So we have these eigenstates which are identified with fields. So let's call them phi j and phi k. Right. Let's say these are primary fields. Now, to get an OPE coefficient, we need to put something in here, right, corresponding to another primary field. What the natural thing to put in here is some Fourier mode of some local operator, some mode expansion, some modes associated with a conformal field. Right? So this would be some local operator. Right? It's a sum with some momentum of some local density. j, phi j. And we could try to determine what this is based on our identification of the states that we've done using hn. So again, similar to what I said, how I replied to Yuto, we could use a variational ansatz for these local operators. And in the case of a primary, what we would want is an operator that, let's say this is the primary field you want. We know what the state is. We are trying to find some operator representation of that field. And what we want is that it creates the field when applied to the vacuum, right? So that's part of the cost function that you would use to do this variational optimization. But so this is something we've explored a bit. It does seem to be a promising way of proceeding, but I don't have any results to show you right now. Okay.
I'm still confused about the fact that all these things are obtained by one particle can excitations. At some point, this thing has to break down, because you know that there are like two parallel scattering states in your Hilbert space. So where are those scattering states?
Yeah. So. Well, the best I can do right now is say that we observed that for the scaling dimensions we visited, this is we only see these one single sum, one particle states. And also, we have kind of a reason for thinking that that's all you get based on the structure of these creation operators in the CFT. So, if these states correspond to conformal fields are local things. The states on the Hamiltonian correspond to Fourier modes of these conformal fields. So if you have a local representation of your field, to get the state or to get a creation operator for the state, you Fourier transform it. That I think is safe to say is true in the continuum. Whether it's also true on the lattice, I guess, is another question. Maybe finite size corrections, high enough momentum, something strange happens. But at least the expectation from CFT, I think, is that you would be able to represent all of these as Fourier modes of local quantities.
But here, I would add that for the Ising model, you have a three-particle description. And for instance, the stress tensor, this excited state with momentum 2 and scaling dimension 2, it's a two particles. And it's quadratic. Right? So it's not single particle, it's two particle.
Right.
But it's single sum. So you have to distinguish between single sum and single particle. These are two different.
And my question is, why are they not double sum?
So I think CFT is telling you they are all going to be double sum, single sum. You can argue in terms of, we argue this greatly now that we've seen the numerical work.
Yeah.
but it was a surprise to us as well. But we have not found yet a single from the example, so we believe now that single sum is enough. The single sum MPS answer is enough to cover all the low energy spectra of the critical spin chain that could be somehow related to scaling operators. If you go very high up in the spectrum for the finite spin chain, you'll find objects excited states which might not be related to anything.
That's why, because things like the Linegan model are so intriguing. You have always these two particle excitations that are kind of both
right.
sums, and they are also kind of critical. And so there, this should not be true. So what is different in this Ising and Linegan excitation?
I mean, as Geoffrey was saying, if you look at how we're generating these guys, they look like double sum things sometimes. Right. So if you start with, say, the spin state, you can find a creation operator which is single sum. Then you apply one of these HN operators, adds a sum. But if we then ask, can we represent the state using, can we create the state using a single sum creation operator? The answer is yes. So it seems like those two sums, due to some commutator that's happening at the local level, become one. At least, yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
Well, let me just ask, have you thought about, or can you do this on a model with simple charge greater than one?
In principle, yes. We haven't tried it. If you can give me a model, then I'd be happy to try it.
there are like spin chains that are now like simple charge three halves. They have supersymmetry.
Right.
In some
right.
cases, so
okay.
It's still easy. But
okay. Yeah. So I'd like to try that. I think it should work.
You know what happens if you like say it's not conformal? Like suppose you take two spin chain and couple them, so it's still scale invariant, perhaps, but not conformal invariant.
Right,
maybe there's two different velocities.
Yeah, well, I mean, since this is based on the structure of the Virasoro algebra. So I believe there is a modified structure in that case. I've looked at the relevant section of a CFT book, and it looks like you can still come up with some generators. You probably know more about this than I do. So assuming there's an analogous structure of these generators, that you could represent them as using the energy density in this case. That's our input data. Or maybe a combination of the energy density and the momentum density. Presumably, in a non-Lorentz invariant case, you might need to do that. And perhaps you can do an analogous construction. Yeah. Okay. If there are no further questions, then... Oh, you're supposed to do that, yeah. Sorry, I chair the CMC.